It's 10 o'clock on May 3rd, 2022. This is the regular meeting of the Finance Committee. Item one is to call the meeting to order. Item two is to consider a finding that as a result of the COVID-19 emergency, meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health or safety of attendees. And the meeting is authorized to be held by teleconference pursuant to Government Code 54953. Marty, do you concur?
I concur.
Okay, we can go to item three, which is comments from the public. Amelia?
I do have a hand raised because like the special finance committee meeting we had a few weeks ago, we're not gonna do chats anymore. We'll just be raising hands and I will call on people in the order that their hands are raised. Of course, with a 3-minute time limit. John Q. Public, if you're ready, go ahead, John Public.
Actually, it's James. I was going to ask you about that chat feature. And what was the rationale for stopping that?
It allows for, Richard, this is Tom Hennig. It allows for better flow of the meeting. Much like when we have a meeting in person for people to speak, they need to come up to the dais and talk, or to the, I lost the word, to the stand up there in the middle of the
podium.
Podium and talk. So it's just a more more regular way of running a meeting. It allows for people not interrupt while people are giving their speeches or their discussions.
Yeah, the analogy of it is that in a regular meeting, you don't talk when someone else is talking. And this is Zoom, and this should really be no different. If this was a public meeting, it wouldn't happen, and it shouldn't happen here.
I disagree with that. I think it was a valuable means of communication, and that actually that text messages over there didn't really interrupt any. And I think it's, I think something is going to be lost. I mean, you're limiting communication from the public, and maybe that's what you want to do, but I think it's a loss. And was that a decision by management or was that a board decision?
The board has not made a formal decision on it. No.
We were just, as the administering part of the district's business, I decided through Amelia's recommendation, I agreed with her that the meeting runs smoother when we handle it this way. And they've been running pretty smooth. You raise your hand and we open up, you get a chance to talk when it's time. And that allows people who are presenting to get their whole product presented without interruption.
Like I say, I disagree. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Anything else, me? Any other hands?
I do have one hand up, John Sullivan.
Okay.
I don't see anything on the agenda for today in regard to the budget for 22/23. Is the only thing on here item five, or is general update on current finance part of that budget discussion?
Paula, Tom, you want to comment on that?
Paula's muted.
Oh.
Sorry, I was muted. No, we are not planning on discussing anything other than current updates on finance. We already had the initial discussion on the Prop 218 notices on March 30th. The upcoming board date for the first hearing is June 1st, and we'll go into a further discussion at that time.
Any other hands, Amelia?
There are no more hands.
Okay, we will move to item four, finance monthly updates, the general update on current finance. Is that going to start with you, Paula?
Yes, it will. Thank you so much. So just some quick updates on our finance reporting. We are working on the financial information. We're still working with the auditors to ensure a complete draft audit report. We have been working with them extensively over the last couple of weeks to ensure that the information that not only have we provided them, but they have provided us, is accurate and complete. We have recently onboarded Robert Half accountant to assist with this process. We are transitioning some staff out with the exit of Jennifer Year, accounting manager, and our retired annuitant Cindy, who is running out of hours, will be transitioning more new staff on board within the next couple of weeks, hopefully to get this completed while we are still recruiting for the accountant and accounting manager position. And I'll talk a little bit more about that when I get down to that point. The contract for the ERP, the team met with the Tyler project management team on Wednesday for scope alignment discussion. Basically, the scope alignment was to talk about the project, the upcoming development phases, and the Tyler project management team had some questions for us that we provided information regarding chart of accounts and processes with utility billing and payroll and so on, so they could get a better idea of some of the challenges that we're facing here and some of the immediate needs that we'll need to tackle during the development phase prior to the implementation. So in the next few months, we're going to start working with the Tyler team. They'll be assigning project managers for the beginning phase. First piece of this is the chart of accounts for training and development. They have a project manager who will be assigned to us that will assist us with developing an entirely new chart of accounts. Current chart of accounts that we have here is very, inconsistent and in some areas too detailed, in others not detailed enough. And we want to make sure that when we move forward with our new chart of accounts, that it's consistent, it applies general accounting principles, and is comprehensive enough so that we can get good reports. I mean, basically, it's garbage in, garbage out, you know, and the reporting that we get is only as good as the accounts that we use to manage the information. And so what we want to do is ensure that moving forward, our reporting is as accurate and detailed as possible to provide both the board and the public with a better understanding of our financial accounting. So moving on to recruitment, again, I have an accounting manager position open. I am recruiting for both an accountant and an accounting manager. Again, the intent behind that is if an accountant comes up that has an excellent skill set, I'm willing to underfill that position with an accountant and then potentially provide for a promotional opportunity in the future. We have secured the services of Robert Half. They are actively working to find us candidates. I am in constant communication with both their consulting side as well as their direct hire side. And the problem that I'm encountering is the commute. A lot of the Sacramento area residents are not interested in commuting an hour one way and working 5 days a week without remote work. A lot of employees got comfortable with the remote with working remote. And so that's presented a significant challenge for us because we are such a small shop. We do need all hands on deck. We do need to be able to interact with one another regularly throughout the day. And, telework is, while it is a option in some cases, it's not a 2 to 3 days a week capability here. And again, Robert Half is working extensively to find us good candidates, good quality candidates to come in and assist us with the accounting side of the house. So moving on to the utility billing, the water shutoff notifications, staff have been working extensively to get customers updated on their bills. We have a significant drop in the amount of 90 days past due, which is absolutely wonderful. I want to thank Melody for all her hard work and Shelby as well for the two of them reaching out to customers and working with them and getting them paid in full or on a customer installment payment plan. That's been extremely helpful to get those balances due. We've not shut off one resident since the moratorium was ended December 31st. And a lot of that is attributed to the outreach that the two of them have conducted over the last few months. Additionally, the district enrolled in the California Low Income Water Assistance Program. This provides federal financial assistance to low-income residents to help manage their residential water utility costs. These funds are administered by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the California Department of Community Services and Development. This program, however, requires extensive staff time to administer the program locally. And it's our enrollment requires us to provide customer outreach, intake, eligibility verification, and identification of the credit amount. We would be working with a third-party vendor regarding the payments. This does allow low-income households to receive a one-time credit of up to $2,000 on their water or wastewater bill. Staff have been hesitant to enroll in this program because of the time and resources that it would take to create a program from scratch. But if this is a need for the community, we're more than willing to get out there and provide that opportunity. We also have the CERA, which is also on our website as well, for low-income renters. And we encourage everyone, if you're eligible for that program, please apply through them as well. We'll have more information on the low-income water assistance program in the May board meeting. Moving on to Prop 218, we've received only 70 protest letters in response to the April mailing of the Prop 218 rate increases. Many of these have been from multiple residents with the same address. So we just wanted to remind the residents that all Prop 218 protest letters must be received either in person via mail, and only one protest letter per property can be counted towards the total protest count. You can be a tenant, you can be an owner, but we can only accept one protest letter per resident. And then that's it. Are there any questions?
Yeah, Paula, on the federal program that allows up to a $2,000 one-time payment, I don't expect that you have this at your fingertips, but as an aggregate of residential customers that are behind on their bills, can you tell me how many would be at a category that would be worth processing this through? In other words, how many of them, for example, owe us more than 1,000? Do you have any idea of the percentage?
I would say it's very few. The majority of the bills are they're probably around $700-$800. There are some that are higher than that, but the majority are around that $700-$800. And it's typically the 3-month mark. So you get 3 to 4 months worth. But there are a couple that are still well beyond the 90-day mark, but the majority of them are around that $700-$800 amount.
Yeah, because I'm wondering, you know, and I don't know the full impact of this. It's just coming out of the top of my head, is that, you know, what we would spend that would allow them to capture perhaps the $800. I don't know how much we invest in this for them to get the $800 is what I'm trying to say. So, you know, based on the other programs we've been working with them on, does it make more sense to pursue those first, or to at least explain to them that it might be in everybody's best interest to pursue those first?
Absolutely. This particular program here is federal low income limits. And so we would have to verify eligibility with, income statements, things of that nature, in order to determine who's actually eligible for this one-time credit. So I think that reduces the actual percentage of those bills that would be processed through this payment program. I couldn't say what the percentage is because I'm not aware of how many residents we have that are eligible under low income programs or are currently in other low income programs. So I think that that also has an impact on, you know, doing a cost benefit analysis for us. It would be probably minimal. But again, if this is something that we have residents who are eligible for, you know, we should at least offer them the opportunity for it.
Is how long, you know, and again, I'm just looking to understand it. How long would it take us as an organization to establish or to identify that eligibility, if you want to call it that, that they would have? Is that something we can do in the first meeting, or do we have to go through, you know, accumulating, you know, great numbers of documents or tax returns or whatever would be required? Is it easy to identify who's eligible and who's not off the first contact?
No, because we would require proof of income. And, you know, there are programs that we can copy. You know, I'm all for pilfering from well-run programs, and then basically accommodating them with our, you know, district needs. And, but ultimately it's up to those residents who feel that they're eligible for this program to contact us. And then we would point them to the California Department of Community Services and Development for the application. From there, they would send it to us, and then we would have to verify their eligibility, run them through the program, and then work with that CSD to provide them with the information necessary so that they could get their one-time credit.
Okay. All right.
John, can I just in here real quick?
Paul, yeah, sure.
Isn't this is a federal program that is cycled through the state, and the state's hired a private firm to manage it, correct?
This is correct. So it's administered through, it's federal funding that was provided to the state of California Community Services and Development. So the state of California received $116 million, which really isn't a lot if you think about it. $116 million to spread across the state for low income recipients. There's another company, the company's name is Horn, and they're the actual financial distributors. So the payments are kind of funded through the CSD, the Department of Services and Development, through Horn, and then Horn pays us. And so there's a process of the money movement between this third party vendor.
Okay. Anything further on this particular part of it? Because I have one more question. Just as a result of the beginning and 2 year period, or however long it's been, I don't even know, of the pandemic, have we transferred any of this debt yet down to Teeter?
No.
Okay. Yeah. How about, no, you don't need to say no again. You know, I tried to convince a few folks on social media that was the case. And I just wanted to reiterate that, you know, we're not headhunting here. You know, we have, I mean, what Paula and the staff have been able to do is really admirable in working with the folks that needed the help. And I am really glad that we have been able to do that. That's what the word community means. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make it real clear that was the case.
So,
to my knowledge, just the other part of that is, even when we do the pass through to Teeter, I don't know that we have ever specifically leaned anyone directly from CSD. We may have done it somewhere along the line, but if we did, I don't ever remember seeing that. And you know, Teeter really is the guarantee to us from the county that we get paid. And then the county takes over the process, which in most cases usually results in a payment to the county when the property is eventually sold. It's not where somebody is ultimately going to be tossed out of their house by the county or by us, or is being forced into an immediate payment in any way. So I just kind of wanted to make that clear.
So John, I want to clarify what you're talking about. And Paula probably wants to say the same thing. When every August we take a look at the amount of the accounts that have a high balance and overdue as of the end of the year. And last year we didn't turn any over. The year before we just turned one account over. In previous years we've turned like 20, 30 accounts over. We focus on the accounts that don't have water meters. And we don't turn them over to Teeter. We turn them over to the county tax collector. And the county tax collector then adds the bill to their tax bill. And then when they collect the taxes, the county then sends us the money.
Right.
Then, so if they don't collect it through the taxes, because people don't want to pay their taxes, then the county has the opportunity. They make a choice of putting it onto the Teeter program. And if you recall, over the past 5 years, we had one year where a lot of the debt related to a bond was put onto the tax roll, and the 1 year ended up on the Teeter program. And the following 2 years, we also put it on the tax roll, but the county chose not to put it on the Teeter program. And we turned around, I believe it was like last September. And then we pulled the debt back from the tax collector and we collected the money on our own. So that's how that works. We don't put it on the Teeter program. That's the county's choice 12 months later.
Right. Yeah, I get that. I probably didn't explain it correctly, but yeah. And there was some consideration along the way in that period where, you know, the county has that option, you know, so if the county elects not to do it, you know, that's really the responsibility of the county. Okay. Anything further, Paula, anything more on the list?
I don't have any. I did want to follow up a little bit on the county with the moratorium. I want to make it clear to everyone who's listening that the moratorium not only prevented us from collecting that debt from our residents, but it prevented us from sending those amounts to the county. So we haven't done any of that over the last 2 years. And we're taking the step here to work directly with the residents so that we don't have to roll those amounts to the county tax rolls. So I just want to make sure that everyone is aware that, you know, our intent is to work directly with the residents, not with the county.
Okay. Amelia, you want to move us back up to the top?
Yes, and we don't have any.
I had one question on
this. Go ahead, Marty.
Regarding audit, what's the expected date of completion?
At this time, I don't have an expected date for you. We've had several meetings with our auditor, and there are a couple of things that we need to clear up. Right now, she's working on the CFD draft. So I would hope to have that within the next couple of weeks, but I don't hold me to that. I don't want to say that that's a for sure thing. So.
Okay.
Okay, Amelia, run us up. There we go. Into discussed item five. Where is that? Where we are? Anything else on four? Anybody? Okay. Item five, discuss the potential impact on reserves with the fiscal year 2022-2023 CIP capital improvements. Tom, is that you or Paula? Or Michael, or all?
Oh, no, that's actually me. In the improvements committee, we discussed the list of CIPs. Amelia, do you have that you can share?
I can make you the host again.
Yeah, that's fine. Go ahead, do that.
Okay.
Okay. So during the improvements meeting, Mike walked through all of these projects and their necessities for the 22-23. We did talk a little bit about the impact to reserves, but primarily one of the funds, the reserve funds that's going to take the biggest hit would be the water. I did just a quick analysis on this to have these numbers available. And ultimately for the water reserves, these are all replacements. Removing the $1.38 million for the smart meter replacement for potential funding puts the water fund replacement reserves in the hole. We have, hold on just one second. I need to pull something up really quick. So basically it puts us at $1,352,000 in the hole if we were to move forward with all of these water projects. Wastewater is fine. It leaves our replacement reserves with $1.8 million moving into next year. But the improvement costs for wastewater puts us in the hole of $164,000. So, and some...
Paul, can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
I might be looking at a different version, but didn't we have a version where the Granley safety improvements and the chlorine gas water plant, chlorine to NAOCI, those are partially funded by the state, right?
They are. I believe these, this was what was shown in the improvements committee. And my understanding was that this was the portion, if not funded through the remainder or through the next round of state funding, that this would be the amount.
The new amount.
With. Correct.
Michael, is that the case?
So that's the amount to complete the project. For example, Granley safety improvements, we do have $170,000 earmarked from state funding for the sodium hypochlorite, which is NaOCl. We have a $750,000 earmarked from that state funding, already soon to be received. And then with the water treatment plant sodium hypochlorite conversion, we have a $352,000 fund for that. But this is counting.
Those funds are in these numbers then,
yes,
right?
That's right.
So then just to be clear for the non-engineering folks, including me, then these are the numbers we're looking at that are the numbers outside of the existing grants that we need to complete the projects?
That's correct.
Okay, good.
Wait a second. I want to be clear about that. So the bottom one, the water plant chlorine gas to NaOCl, the 892 is Michael's estimate for the whole project, but 750 of the 892 is state funded already? I mean, there's
892. Oh yeah, yeah. No, 352,000 of that. So really it's an additional 540,000 somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when we bring this forward to the budget, let's put a note on to the side of those that says existing state funding of this amount, and this amount is included.
Yeah, I'm personally more concerned about understanding what we need to complete it. I mean, it would assume, I assume that the grant is the equivalent of a reserve in that we have one way or another accumulated the money to complete that portion of the project. So when I'm trying to evaluate reserves going forward, I would want to know particularly that this is the amount of money we need to reserve or we need to pull from reserves in addition to what we already have. And Marty, you're probably better at this than I am. What do you see here?
Yeah, I guess it depends on whether or not, we haven't received the money. We're supposed to get the money, but when we get the money, it'll go into one of those reserve accounts or whatnot.
It'll go, the SB 170 money will go into a separate line item in our general ledger, and we'll make sure we spend that money only on that project.
So then it gets treated essentially as a restricted reserve, correct?
Yeah, as a very restricted reserve.
Okay.
So I guess your answer is yes, Marty.
And okay, so I suppose this is the biggest issue, is how much are we going to deplete the reserves? That's all.
Yeah, here's what I have been trying to understand going forward with the whole issue of reserves and reserve funding. I'm trying to get my arms around, and you know, we're going there with the short term with what we're looking at. But I'm trying to understand that based on, let's just describe one of the two and not mix them up for a minute. Let's just go to sewer reserves, and we know what we have in existing sewer reserves. We know both in the short term and perhaps a little bit further out in the medium term what we need to remove from those reserve funds to accomplish those retrofits and replacements and repairs that we're going to do on sewer. So the next number that I'm kind of trying to understand is, after we spend that money, short and medium term, is what's the state of our sewer reserve and how much we would need in the five-year period to capture to bring that fund back to a comfort level where we had another 5 years worth of money to satisfy what we forecast as being the needs for sewer in the next 5 year period. And I understand too that, you know, we look at this on a 30-year basis, but in the short term, with the amount of money we're assessing that we need to capture 60% reserve rates, how does that all fit together? And how does that blend with what we're asking for this year and what we probably would be asking for in the immediate terms of year 2, 3, 4, and 5? Does that make any sense? Because when I describe it this way, essentially, I think I'm maybe asking some of the questions that those of us that are not engineers and those of us even that are less connected with the CSD on a day-by-day basis might try to understand the problem.
So basically what you're looking for is a five-year analysis. So what this first year impact will be on collections moving forward, which would probably adjust what we had anticipated if the board had approved years 2 through 5. Is that what I'm hearing you ask?
Yeah. So basically, yes. So here's what that means to me in the thought process. I'm not saying we do this, but, you know, we have a reaction to based in part on the whole CSD increase. And it's based on partly on what we forecast for reserves, partly on what people believe about our operating budget. And so if there's any relief, okay, in the ability to spread out the reserve contribution, it offers an opportunity on June 3rd to take another look at that. And again, I'm not advocating for anything here. I'm asking questions. So the numbers that I would like someone to explain to me systematically through year 1, maybe year 2 or 3, and then year 5, and then subsequently, okay, what do we spend out of that first 5 year period, and what do we recapture at the current level, and what do we recapture with the money we're taking in as a result of this increase that we're proposing, and where does that put us at the end of the 5 year period? And if you're telling me at the end of the 5 year period that we're $2,000 in the hole, well, you know, that tells me that we got a big problem and we need to react to it. And what we're proposing is completely justified. And I'm not saying it's not completely justified already. I'm just not being able in my head to tie it to the numbers. I just want to make sure I'm trying to describe things that I don't understand. So I'm not even sure if it makes sense. Does it make sense what I'm saying?
John, it makes sense to me what you're saying. I'm going to work with Michael on, Michael's done all the work mostly on the CIP items and the more critical ones being worked on in the next 5 years and the less critical ones, you know, as time goes by. And I'll ask Michael to go through that and kind of clean it up to show you what the 5 year looks like and how much funding we have. We'll work with Paul on the dollars, but we'll put something together that is a little bit easier to track. And if you don't mind, we'll sit down with you and Marty individually ahead of time to see if that works for you.
That's fine. The other part of that, I want to counterbalance that somewhat with another perception that I have. And I watched the Improvements Committee meeting, and I thought Michael and Paula have done a really remarkable job in cleaning up what existed from the 2014 and 2016 reserve analysis, taking out a lot of the garbage that was in there, taking out stuff that we've completed, et cetera. Okay, and we have accelerated projects in here that only because we had the ability to do so, because we got a little juice from Mr. Cooley and we got some money. Those are very valuable projects. And starting with the, like back to water for a minute, the Grand Lease safety improvements, okay, that came out of a very, very unfortunate incident back in 2006 when I was the president of the board and I signed the settlement, and I know what that did to the community and did to our pocketbook. Okay. It's taken us this long to fix it. And that money jump-started it, and taking the money to finish it is a damn good idea. I think what Michael's done with the conversion from the chlorine gas, both from a water quality issue and from the fact that the cost of chemicals is accelerating out of control, I think that those things that even in the planning phase and then in the implementation phase got jump-started with some Cooley money, then those are really good things. But part of what we're saying here is that, you know, a lot of the really quality implementations we want to do to the water sewer systems in this community are being done based on what we can beg for. Okay, so yeah, we'll do that if we can beg the money out of the state. Well, at some point, you know, maybe we're a little bit more aggressively looking at some of this quality enhancement to our system, as opposed to taking care of the really, really critical stuff that we need money for, which is like fixing lift stations. So, you know, there's problems and concerns on both sides of this fence, but you know, the public perception that we don't need this money is ludicrous, and so I'm done. I apologize.
So are you going to come back and prioritize these line items?
We'll be presenting this at the May board hearing. So I believe Mike and I will probably have a joint presentation regarding these projects and their impact to reserves. And yes, prioritization will be among some of those discussion topics.
I'd like to make a comment if I may. This is Michael. I would say that pretty much all these projects are a priority. I mean, yes, there's some nice pet projects. If we can do them, if we can't get the funding, we will. But, you know, if you take a look at the, you know, 5 year plan, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done yesterday. And it was tough to spread over 5 years. You know, for whatever reason, some of this infrastructure has been a can that's been kicked down the road for a while. And, you know, I applaud the board for the bravery of looking into this and saying, hey, we need the buck stops here. We need to implement this. So there's really, yeah, we could provide some kind of priority, but all the, I mean, the first 5 years is going to be a lot of catch up.
Yeah, except you can't let the balance go to zero.
Oh, I realize that, and that's exactly why staff recommended what we recommended for the reserve infusion.
And I think you know, and I agree with Marty. We're damn sure not going to let it go to zero. Matter of fact, you know, in layman's terms, it ought to damn well be in 5 years from now, we ought to do everything that Michael is talking about we need to do, and we ought to have exactly the same amount of money in there after we do it. Okay. At a minimum, that gives us a jump off point for the next 5 years. So in no way do we let the balances in our reserve accounts suffer to a critical level. But what I was driving at in trying to have that conversation is the message is in there. And I think part of our problem is in delivering the message. Okay, I'm not sure people, there's a bunch of people out there who are against this because we're asking them to pay more money and it goes no further than that, but that's not what the community thinks as a whole. But I think delivering the message in a way that they understand what Michael just said, okay, that there's a lot of catch up in here. And you know, it's going to cost us money to do that. I think that helps folks to understand the magnitude of the problem and why the amount of money we're asking for is what it is. So, you know, I think going forward between now and that final meeting before we vote is, I think we need to try and do something to facilitate that message. And one of the things that Tom and I talked about this week was, you know, I got in touch with some of the folks that are leading this protest. And essentially we extended to them an opportunity to meet with us. And by us, I meant in person, and as a team of the folks that run the district, and that's Tom and Paula and Michael and Kelly, to go through their concerns, and I haven't had a response from them. But I'm not so sure that whether I get a response from them or not, that we should just not go ahead and have this meeting and open it up to anybody in the district who wants to attend. You know, I think that in the end, whether this thing was to gain enough votes to overturn the 218, or not, I think we lose because going forward, we generally, the folks here don't understand what it really costs us to run this small city that manages its own water, sewer, drainage, and oh yes, $2 million worth of security that nobody else does. So I would hope that, you know, at least two people would attend this meeting and maybe we could get that message out. Tom, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I've checked with Michael, Kelly, and Paula, and we're more than happy to next Tuesday night at 5 o'clock open the doors of our boardroom. And I'll take the questions, and if I get stuck, I'll look to the left or the right and see if Michael and Kelly or Paula can assist. And I think education and outreach is critical at this point in time. The ramifications of this successful Prop 218 protest are pretty clear. If you don't mind, I'll explain it real quick. You want to hear it?
Oh, absolutely.
So we've checked with our attorney, and basically the security and drainage special tax is 2%, and we're going to go ahead and implement that special tax. It actually does not belong as part of the 218 notice, and we're going to discontinue listing those taxes as part of the 218 notice because they're actually not part of it. The water and sewer and trash rate are part of the Prop 218 process. And if, in fact, enough of the protests are turned in and validated, we have to validate them all, by the way. We have to validate them. We can't take someone's word for it. And we do that by checking names, account numbers, and stuff like that. But if enough come in to go 50% plus one, then what happens is, to begin with, the rates just stay the same. So we just, in July, charged the same amount we charged in June. And then we go back to the drawing board and try to develop another budget. And at this point in time, from what I'm understanding, this protest might actually overturn our proposed budget rates, and then we'll have to circle back. So we cannot decrease staff in water and sewer. We are regulated by the government to provide healthy water and proper transmission of black water or sewer water. And we have no choice. If we don't do it correctly, we are subject to all sorts of fines and penalties, and it's not pretty. So we would then have to shift the money we need to run water and sewer. We'd have to shift property taxes to help supplement those services during the time when we were going back with another Prop 218 notice to adjust our rates. And, you know, half the rate increase is reserves, and the other half is operations. So if people, I'm more than happy to take the time and answer as many questions as possible. But the bottom line is, you know, the district has to provide healthy drinking water and a proper disposal of wastewater. And that's the law. And I don't know how we do it if we don't. Obviously, in the reserve discussions, it was brought up that maybe the district needs to start borrowing money as opposed to collecting money every month to put a good amount of money in reserves to be able to handle what Michael calls things that should have been done yesterday. And he's right. We're seeing that at lift station 6A because the fines for that lift station failing, I don't even know what they'd be, but it wouldn't be attractive. If we actually had a spill into Bass Lake. So to answer the question for water and sewer, we would just have to supplement those budgets with property taxes until we found another funding mechanism, which would probably be another 218 notice. For security and drainage, we're looking at just increasing the amount, the 2% that we're allowed by law and moving forward with that. And then for trash, I've been thinking about this, and, you know, if we can't raise the trash rates, then we have to start supplementing that with property taxes as well, because it's trash is a pass-through. So one of the things I was looking at is the bulk waste pickup. And, you know, where I live, I think we pay $60 to use a bulk waste container, and Recology drops it off, and a week or two later, they come and get it and charge me $60. Here at Rancho Marietta, there's four bulk waste pickups built into the billing cycle. So, you know, everybody else around here, all the other agencies around here, people pay for bulk pickup number one through X. So I'm going to ask Cal Waste to adjust the price to have zero bulk pickups and see if that fits within the rates we currently charge, which would allow us to, which might allow us to not have to utilize property taxes to offset our monthly trash bill. I know I went on for a long time, but does that make sense, John?
It does to me. There's part of the discussions that we've had with Cal Waste to this point, you know, have been around the reduction in the special bulk pickups. But, you know, what I think going forward, just to make it real clear, what we understand is the mandates of the state for the new concepts of recycling food wastes are gonna drive that number up to a point where, you know, reducing bulk pickups alone is not going to compensate it. So at some point after the grace period, which I think runs maybe January, you know, we're going to have a bigger trash bill. There's other parts of this that fit in that when I listen to, for example, the Laguna Joaquin discussion on the improvements meeting, and everybody understands that the folks that surround Laguna Joaquin don't want to deal with the smell and they don't want to deal with the midge flies. And, you know, everybody completely understands that. And we have these conversations about moving water up and downhill and placing raw water back into Laguna Joaquin, all of which are beneficial in that, you know, it makes living around that facility a lot more livable. But, you know, we now, who are the owner operators of a drainage ditch, you know, talk about increasing costs over a drainage ditch to a lake with a water quality and problems that are not associated with what simply running a drainage ditch would be. Okay, so, and again, that's on our back. And it's on our back at the same time that we're getting people balking left and right about their bill going up. And the, you know, there's lots of this that you know, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer on, but the one thing I do understand is, you know, when I ran the Excel numbers on the average bill for a 10-year period, and I think it was when I did it, it was from, again, from 2006 to 2016, there was a philosophical understanding, I don't know what to call it, that, you know, that low rates was a really good thing, and it proved just how good we really were. And as a result of that, the aggregate increase over that 10-year period in the average bill, you know, year to year, was underneath 3%. Okay. And we really, just from that standpoint alone, put ourselves in the hole, because the only place you can go and get that money is from reserves. And what you do to keep that bill at that level is you don't make the necessary contributions. And we're now at a point where it's 2022 and we're eating it. And at some point, like Michael says, there's things we need to do in the short term, and we need to make sure that we got enough money to do it. So, you know, yeah, it probably is a shift in philosophy, but, you know, it's, in some respects, it's tough love. I mean, you know, we either fix it or we don't. I mean, and like Tom pointed out, that property tax money, which at this point in time, and I don't have the number exactly in my head, that we're taking pretty close to $500,000 out of that to prop up security with it, because we don't collect enough out of the security tax. If we don't get these increases, that's where the money's going to come from. And the money that we collect from the security tax is what it is. And that's where the implication, that's where you're going to feel it the most, and the most in the most immediate short term. So I'm sorry too, there's a lot of this, and I'm just trying to grapple with it and understand it all and figure out where we go with it and how we better communicate what the problem is, because it's a problem.
And John, I want to say it again, relative to the trash pickups. Currently, every 2 weeks, Cal Waste makes 4 trips to every household.
Right.
Once a week, they pick up trash, and every other week, they pick up recyclables, and the other every other week they pick up the every other week they pick up the garden waste, the green waste. So they will have to add a second green waste trip to every week. So not every week, but the same week they pick up recycle, they're also going to have to pick up green waste. So they go from 4 trips every 2 weeks to 5. And that's where the big increase is. They also have to outfit their trucks. They got to buy new trucks. And they've also got a pretty good infrastructure problem as far as how they handle organics and green waste. They currently are not set up to handle organics and green waste internally, so they ship it out. So this, I believe it's SB 1383. It requires everybody to separate organics from their regular trash. It's a state mandate. It's what's known as an unfunded state mandate, which 20 years from now, the state will probably start reimbursing municipalities or people for the cost of the unfunded state mandate, but it's there. We can't avoid it. By January 1, this trash thing has to be changed to where they make that fifth trip every 2 weeks. So we've been publishing this in the pipeline. We have it on our webpage. But the reality is people will notice it come January 1 when they see their green waste getting picked up every week. So I just wanted to take this opportunity to be clear about that.
Yeah, the other question that I would like to ask, and perhaps this meeting that we want to hold next week is a good place for it, is, you know, and there's an issue when I went out and I did that competitive analysis on all these different districts. It became apparent in that analysis that, you know, we're kind of an unusual duck anymore in that we pay our own way. And everybody else, when you start looking at the big boys like San Juan, and you look at the people that support them on sewer and wastewater, like Regional San, you know, when they need money, they just go run another bond out there and they borrow it. And it spreads out the pain. But at the end, like, I think it was San Juan, when I looked at them, they're running now on 3 individual bond issues that they've just lopped one on top of the other. So if you level it to say, oh, I get a bunch of money and I get it for $12 a month, you know, 6 years from now, you need more money. So you level it. And the 12 a month you're paying is still there, but then you borrow another 12. And then 5 years later, you borrow another 12. Well, that looks great for the guys that are in power right now, but the guys 15 years from now are going to eat it like we are, because somebody at that point is going to say, wait, I'm already paying, you know, $48 a month here or $36 a month. So, you know, we've avoided, we're running up $55 million worth of assets here, and we don't have any liabilities. I mean, you know, we got a PERS liability that the whole world has if they're in the public business, but you know, we don't have all that outstanding debt, which probably for a community of 2,600 people is, you know, 2,600 ratepayers is not a bad idea. But, you know, this money is necessary. We need to have this money.
You know, John, could I interject for a quick second on these debt obligations?
Yeah.
You know, in my experience, having worked in a couple of municipalities with debt obligations, I think, you know, you're absolutely correct. And the upfront it's great. It looks fantastic on paper. You know, the residents pay minimal, but you end up in this never ending cycle of debt, because what ends up happening is that bond debt gets refinanced for a lower rate. And then you add additional financing on top of that because there's another immediate need, because the original debt obligation was finance to cover a certain portion of infrastructure needs. And then once those needs have been addressed, you still have this outstanding debt. And so it gets refinanced, you add to it. And so every 10, 15 years, this never-ending cycle of debt obligations goes larger and larger and larger and larger. And speaking from experience with one of my previous employers, they may have had $200 million in cash and investments, but they had almost the same amount in debt obligations as well. And you don't want to be in that position where your net cash is very minimal when you have a $300 million budget. So it's something to consider, but because we are such a small organization and a small district in and of itself, it would be a difficult burden on the residents 10, 20, 50 years down the road, because even if the district is growing, it's not growing enough to cover that debt, that increasing debt obligation. So you're going to be in a never ending cycle of debt.
Thank you, Paula. The other part of that that I think is important to reinforce, and again, I'm really liking the fact that we're going to extend ourselves out to try and do this meeting, is when you start looking at CSD as a public utility, okay, and you look at your average bill, or you look at a 218 notice that says my bill will go up by X. Included in that bill on an $8.5 million budget is, in round numbers, give or take $2 million worth of security. Okay. Security is not a public utility. Okay. So when you do competitive analysis, okay, and when you run our numbers and you compare them to other districts, and when you run our utility numbers as a function of the 218, okay, we don't look all that bad, okay? But we've just added 22% to the overall average bill based on the fact that we run two gates, three employees, 24/7, 365 days a year, and we run a patrol, okay? And we allocate a generous portion of our overhead to that security, and every bit of it is justified because security here is a way of life. Okay, so I'm not sure in the context of looking at what we provide, security is yes, it's in the bill because yes, we provide it, but when, you know, it needs to be understood, okay, that it's an over and above cost that the people in this community have chosen to pay for. And it just makes it tougher to sell the whole increase and the whole budget with, you know, virtually a quarter of what we do not being attached to the water, sewer, and drainage. So I'm not recommending we doing anything to change what we do, but I am recommending that we figure out a better way to communicate that. And we've kind of set up an option down the road here in allowing the community to vote for what they want us to do with security. And part of that process needs to be understanding what that does to the overall bill that you're going to get from CSD on a monthly basis. We've got to communicate those things. Anything else?
Yeah, I have a question, I guess, for regarding these estimates. When will we get the preliminary estimate on these projects like Grand Lees and the sodium hyperchlorate? What's the schedule to get those preliminary estimates?
Oh, sorry, I was muted. So with the water treatment plant, I think we're probably looking at getting to the traditional 30% design level probably sometime late June, early July.
Okay.
With the wastewater plant conversion, we did get a preliminary estimate from the report that was done when we were comparing it to UV, and that's where we got that $1.2 million. $1.2 million number.
Say that again. You got it from what?
We got it from the. I don't know if you recall that study that was done when we were comparing.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah, the sodium hypochlorite to the UV. That's where we received that initial number. We'll get a we'll get a better kind of updated 30% design number once we get the RFP out and get someone started on design. Grand lease,
Let's go back to the wastewater. The RFP is going to be, or the consultant is going to be selected in, say, 2 months, and in another 2 or 3 months to get the preliminary design. So that's,
yeah, that's probably about right. Yeah.
So that means October.
Yeah, maybe before.
So it isn't even feasible to have some of these. Oh, and okay, now the ground lease is, when's that going to get the 30%?
Well, HDR was awarded the contract to do the preliminary design.
Mm-hmm.
So that contract has been approved. And so my assumption would be sometime in potentially in July. July to August.
So is it even feasible to have these out the door for construction in next fiscal year?
It's potential. Yeah, it's somewhat feasible.
Okay.
Depending on how fast the design gets done. Okay. You know, it's one of those things that if they get, you know, if the designer gets done fairly soon, you'll want the money in the budget to complete the project before the end of the fiscal year. And some of these, you know, may span two fiscal years over a summer, right? Because July 1's right smack dab in the middle of summer.
Okay.
But it's been my experience, you need to budget for the entire project in case they get things done on time or sooner. We definitely don't want to delay a construction project in the middle of a project.
Okay. Last question is for Tom. Do we have an opinion from our attorney as whether or not the solid waste is subject to Prop 218?
It is, yes, from our attorney as well.
Can you send that to me?
Yeah, I'll do that.
Any more here?
I do have one hand raised if you're ready to accept comments.
Sure, go ahead.
James Q. Public, go ahead.
Hi. In the context of what John was talking about a little while ago, I'm wondering, you know, I look at this screen in front of me and I'm seeing almost $2 million for rainwater harvesting. And, you know, that kind of makes me think, you know, how is that a priority? I mean, you know, $2 million, that's a lot of money, and it's for rainwater harvesting. I mean, that's my reaction. Maybe it's worth it, but could somebody explain that to me?
Well, part of Richard or James, part of what they discussed, like in the previous meeting, was some issues around even RMA and the rerouting and the use of potable water to on landscaping to get out of the problems they have now, and understanding that there's probably a 3 or 4 month window both on the front and the back end in this community where, you know, we're restricted in the ability to pump. I, you know, any place you can capture water here, based on the fact that we you know, it probably is less of an issue if we could just pump willy-nilly all year long. But I don't discount the benefit in rainwater harvesting or any other form of usable water collection. Okay, there's a difference between water that comes out of the sky that's collected and stormwater that's running down the street with all the Roundup that just came off somebody's lawn. So, you know, and again, you're right. I mean, you know, if we're going to sit here, we could probably lower the bill if we just said, well, we'll sit here and we'll just fix what breaks. You know, we won't push ourselves out to convert from chlorine, or we won't push ourselves out to enhance the recycled water program. But I'm not sure I agree with the philosophy that some of these projects that push us forward in terms of conservation and the ability to deliver water and deliver cleaner water are not worth the money. So any other stuff out there, Amelia? We can move on to the next item.
That's all. And if Paula will give me back control, or I can take back control.
It's all about control. Get control.
I know, it's all about the control.
Get control here.
Okay, and I believe you can see my screen again.
We can. So we are, I guess, to director and staff comments. Is that where we are?
Yes.
So my first comment is, could you, Amelia, could you get with me sometime next week? The board meeting I need to do remotely. I can do it, but we'll have to figure that out. Secondly, Tom, then we're moving forward with a meeting for next Tuesday.
Tuesday, 5 to 7.
Okay. Can we stipulate? Let's stipulate that, you know, even if we have to get a pizza, we hang around till 7. So if anybody gets off from work later than 5, they still have the ability to show up.
Sure.
Okay. And maybe we publicize it as such.
Yeah, we'll put it on our website. I think we might be able to find one or two other ways to let people know we're going to do it. We'll talk to the RMA.
Yeah. Okay. And reserve for the pizza then, if you would. I have no other comments. Marty, you have anything?
No, I don't have anything to add.
Tom or any of the staff?
I do have something to add, and it's a really happy discussion. We have, right now we have about 140 little white flags spread around the turf area here at the district office. The folks from the SAC Tree Foundations were out here yesterday putting flags down, and you'll get an idea of where all the different trees are gonna go. As of today, and 8 people sign up to volunteer to plant trees on May 21st. That's a Saturday, just 3 Saturdays from now. It's going to be really cool. It's going to be a big statement that the district is promoting water conservation. And we're going to see all these little trees planted, a nice community event. They want as many as 50 volunteers. And every volunteer will get to go plant 2 or 3 trees, and they'll be, you know, told what tree to take where. And they had an arborist kind of set up our design. So it's very exciting to take what's sad to see the oak trees removed from the Riverview property turn into a bunch of native trees here right in front of the district office for people to see, and for us to take a stand on water conservation, I think is critical right now.
What's so the date again?
May 21st.
Okay.
I see Gail on the line. I know we've sent her a flyer. It's on our webpage. We talk about it in the pipeline. Amelia can probably send something over to the RMA and the village. And maybe we get some community involvement on a good note instead of worrying about money all the time.
Okay. Any other comments?
No more comments here.
Okay, and with that, then we can move to adjournment, and everyone have a nice day. Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Thank you.